the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
We need to talk about Roy. There's only one Roy, really, when we're going to talk about Roy. It's Roy Keane. Dave Hannigan, who you know very well over the years as a contributor to The Last Word, has written a terrific book, Roy, The Keanification of Modern Ireland. This is not just a sports book. It is about a sports character, but it's about way, way more than that. You don't have to be interested in football or sport or necessarily even Roy Keane to enjoy this, because this is about the way Ireland has changed over the last 40 years or so. Dave Hannigan, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
So it's not a biography of Roy Keane. Tell us why you've taken this approach in writing about him.
I think my approach basically here was that I've always felt, well, certainly for the last 10 years, I felt that Keane's entire life story kind of mirrors that of Ireland, or is intertwined with Ireland. And he has changed Ireland, and Ireland has changed, and he has changed along the way. And I thought of telling his story, but intertwining it with the story of Ireland. Like, he came out of this terrible, grim 1970s period of Irish history, and now we've been obsessed with him for the last 30 years. And now he's this content creator, you know, grey-bearded influencer who is, you know, impacting on a whole new different generation. There's been battles with drink in there. There's the tabloidization of Ireland. Ireland developing a graw for rugby, or a wider graw for rugby, and Keane developing, or Keane impacting on Irish rugby in a very strange way. So there's a lot of different elements of it. Celtic, Man United, all parts of the Irish story, if you like, over the last 50 years. And he seems central to so many of these stories.
And so much of the book about Cork, but I'm definitely not starting there in case I put off some of our listeners. I am very interested in, though, a topic that you handle, I think, with great sensitivity, is his relationship with alcohol and Ireland's relationship with alcohol. Because you set out how, up until about the age of 30, he did drink a lot, and then he stopped. And you talk about the sort of the language that we use in relation to how people have a relationship with alcohol in Ireland and how that's changed. Well, for a modern generation, seems to be a very different relationship. Tell us a little bit about how you approached what can be a very sensitive subject.
Yeah, the chapter on drink is actually, you know, that was the toughest chapter to write, because you got to be very sensitive, you know, when you're writing about somebody's relationship with alcohol, because it's a very private thing. But Keane has shared a lot over the course of his career about drink. He has spoken very eloquently about drink and its place in his life and the impact it had, the negative impact it had on his career, and almost how it derailed his career, if you like. So there's a lot of very, very, you know, telling, smart, insightful quotes from him about drink. And then the other side of it, he still indulges in this thing that we all do in Ireland, I think, where we, even if we don't drink anymore, we like to tell stories of the, of this, you know, ridiculous things we did in drink, you know, the bad behaviour in drink that you can laugh about now, kind of thing.
So sorry, not recommending that you do this, but at the same time, sort of having a little bit of a laugh. Sure, weren't we mad back then?
That's exactly it. It's like, you know, didn't we do, I did this crazy thing once when I was drunk, kind of thing. And he specializes in those stories because he's got a lot of very entertaining stories about his drinking days. But he had this very public, you know, relationship with drink, obviously, because he was a tabloid fixture. So every time Keane went out and did something, it was front page news. You know, the rest of us could go out and do whatever we want. But when Keane, you know, took a misstep with drink, it became a huge story in Britain and in Ireland. So he had this very public relationship with it. And then he, you know, he's very adamant. He's not an alcoholic, but he knew he had to stop. And then he stopped. And then, you know, for the last couple of decades, drink doesn't seem to have played a part in his life. And, you know, Ireland is like that. I mean, he grew up in Ireland in the 1970s. You know, drink was everywhere in our childhoods, and it was on TV, and it was advertising, and it was, you know, it was part of the culture. And so he came out of that. But now the Ireland where Keane is obviously a major figure, he doesn't drink anymore. The Ireland of today, as I know, as a visitor to that Ireland, I'm always taken aback, you know, by that there are more gyms now than pubs, you know, and more coffee shops. And there's a very different attitude towards drink amongst younger people,
and Dave,
just in my eyes, as a visitor.
Yeah, as a visitor, given that you've been living in the United States for well over 20 years now, when you come back and see that, do you think Ireland's a better place for that?
Oh, I do. Absolutely. I mean, I know there's people in Ireland who really hate people who go and live abroad and come back and speak about drink. But I think drink has destroyed lives. It's destroyed lives of my own family, you know, and I think in every family in Ireland. And I really think it has been a negative force in Irish life, you know, for the longest time. And you know, so absolutely, I think it's an improvement that anytime there's less drinking, I think Ireland's in a better place.
And I just want to mention two other of our greatest footballers of all time in the context of alcohol as well, and also newspaper coverage. George Best, who was one of the greatest talents ever in football, certainly to come out of Ireland, but also internationally. And it's widely perceived his career was ruined by alcoholism. Paul McGrath is probably the most loved footballer of the 80s and 90s and a wonderful person. And he very publicly had his own issues with alcohol consumption as well. And then you had Roy Keane, but who did give it up at the age of 30 to extend his career a little bit. But it does raise the question because it seems to have had a physical impact on him as well as having a mental impact when he was engaged in heavy drinking in his 20s. He possibly couldn't have had a better career than he had. Or could he have been an even better player? Could he have had a longer career if he actually hadn't been a drinker?
Well, I think he has spoken about like how drinking during recovery from his knee injury and stuff had a negative effect on his body. I don't know enough about the physiology of Roy Keane to speculate on whether he could have played on. I think the way he played the game was always going to make it difficult for him to have a kind of a, you know, to keep going deep into his 30s. I don't think he could have achieved much more than he achieved, although I think there was a sadness to the fact that he went to Celtic for this kind of very kind of almost pathetic coda to his career in 2006 when he could have went to Real Madrid. But I think his argument there was I suspect he did not believe he was physically up to playing for Real Madrid at that point of his career.
And it's very telling how you mention as well that while he did allow sentiment to bring him to Glasgow to play for Celtic, when it came to the opportunity to manage the club about a decade later, he was far more hard-headed about it.
Yeah, he took, you know, there's a story in the book about Gordon Strachan and Brian Robson, who were both managing Premier League clubs at the time, both tried to get him Strachan was managing Celtic, Brian Robson was managing a Premier League club, and he basically Robson tried to get him, and Strachan got him for way less than Robson was offering. And Robson couldn't understand, like, what are you giving him? And Strachan explained, we're giving him, you know, pennies because he just wanted to come and play for Celtic. So he left a lot of money on the table to go and play for Celtic. I mean, he'd made a lot of money, and Celtic obviously he had an affinity. There was a romance there. It wasn't very romantic the way it turned out in the end. But, you know, he did make that decision for football reasons or for sentimental reasons, definitely not for financial reasons.
Go back to his upbringing in Cork, and I'm about 5 years older than you, but I remember all of the Cork that you describe in the book very, very well. And you would have been a contemporary of Roy Keane. You actually even played on the same football pitch as him as a teenager. The Cork of then is so, so different. And yet, Roy Keane loves that Cork, I think, doesn't he? Not just the family that he still has there, but he regularly returns to Cork, I say, an awful lot more than you or I are able to.
He does, and he's always promoting Cork too, if you notice. Like, he's very positive about Cork and promoting Cork businesses and you know, giving shout-outs to Cork on the show, having Jimmy Barry Murphy on the overlap and stuff like that. You know, there is a real genuineness to his connection to Cork, and I think you touch upon it there, like Cork in the 70s and 80s, Ireland in the 70s and 80s, it's not just a Cork thing. Those were grim decades. You know, those were grim places without much promise or potential. And, you know, nobody knew that, you know, things were going to get really much better for everybody over the course of the 90s and into the 2000s. You know, there was no sense of that when you were growing up in the 70s and 80s. And Roy Keane would have been of that world. He would not have had great prospects in his mid-teens, apart from the kind of the football dream, which always seemed just like a faraway dream for most kids.
Yeah, but then you write about, particularly in the 1990s, when he was making it, first of all at Nottingham Forest in the 3 years he was there, and then when he moved to Manchester United, the degree of begrudgery that there was in Cork, which often ended up in him being baited by people around Cork when he was out maybe around Patrick Street and in St. Varens for a few drinks and a night out when he was at home. People giving out to him, trying to wind him up, getting him into bother. People cheering when Manchester United lost matches because it didn't matter to them that there were two Cork lads on the team. They still had a greater affinity for Liverpool or Leeds or whoever it was, as long as it wasn't Manchester United.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary, that was an extraordinary time because there was real jealousy and real begrudgery there. And I remember, you know, I've write about this in the book and I've mentioned it before in various articles, being outside Cuban's nightclub in Cork, just off Washington Street. And Keane had played that day for Ireland on a Saturday afternoon. This was Saturday night and, you know, the place was packed and people are trying to get into the club or whatever. And we stood back and we watched Keane approaching the door with a couple of his friends. Now, they weren't, you know, he wasn't, you know, large in it, as they say. He was just approaching the door like anybody else. And he got turned away. And I remember thinking, like, you know, if he's in England now, approaching the door of a club in Nottingham or Manchester, you know, as a celebrity footballer, not only would they let him in, they would be bringing him in and putting a carton around his table and, you know, giving him the whole treatment, like, as a VIP. And here he is. And I was watching the bouncer that night, and the bouncer was like, this was nice. He was enjoying this. You know, this was his moment. He was going to put the, you know, Roy Keane was the most sought after. It was the summer of 93 or May 1993. But Roy Keane that summer was going to be the most sought after footballer in England, and millions of pounds and all that kind of stuff being thrown at Forest to take him. And this guy was loving the moment of, you know, showing Roy Keane, I have the power here.
Yeah, but there's a second thing to that though, Dave. That, you know, maybe there was a bit of good for Roy in that. It kept it grounded that he wasn't getting the VIP treatment in Cork and getting the roped off area of Cubans and whatever. That it's brought him back down to earth. He was still one of us.
Yeah, because we all got rejected at those doors. We all knew well. We all knew well the pain of rejection. Not tonight. Not tonight, son. It's not your night.
See, I'm old enough to remember when I was Spiders before I became Cubans, but that's another issue. And then you take it through. I suppose also you go to Saipan. And Saipan is back in the news again because of the movie. But I think you do a great job of putting it in different contexts as well, that how ludicrous it was when you consider all the lives that were lost in Saipan at the time of the Second World War, far, far more important than this so-called Second Civil War that we had breaking out in Ireland. And the ludicrousness maybe as well at the time when we were starting to lose a run of ourselves in the midst of the Celtic Tiger. Were you ever guilty of taking a side during that one, Dave?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I was on Roy Keane's side.
Yeah, you're not too kind to Mick McCarthy as a manager in the book.
No, I'm not. I'm a Cork man first, you know, before I'm anything else, surely. No, I was on Keane's side, but I also, like, objectively, I teach history to college students here, and Saipan means something completely different in the classrooms of America than it does in Ireland, which is, you know, a hilarious contrast to me. Or, I mean, it's not hilarious, really, given what happened there. The Americans are still bringing back bodies from Saipan and identifying them and burying them, giving them funerals, full military funerals, all these years later. And we are still, I think the movie shows, we're still picking over the entrails of Saipan and kind of picking at the corpse of it. But no, I was on Keane's side because I was on Keane's side, and I also was against, like, the FAI in terms of they knew this was going to happen one day because everybody knew that the best player and the manager didn't get on, and everybody just ignored it. They didn't even talk. You had to talk to him through an intermediary. And you're like, what organization runs like that? Well, the FAI, obviously. But, you know, I think from my point of view writing about it today, it was interesting to comb over the coverage from 2002 and look at how nuts Ireland went, like how collectively insane the country went in terms of our reaction to that event.
Yeah, absolutely. But I wonder as well, did it also show up this thing? Everyone wanted to believe there was more to it, that they knew more than the actual straightforward story, that it couldn't just be that Roy Keane was fed up with the facilities being provided, that there was something deeper going on underneath it all.
Oh, I know. There was all sorts of scurrilous rumors and conspiracy theories about what was going on there. But actually, when you look at it and look at Roy Keane's behavior before, you know, his form for United, he was in good form for United. He'd played a lot of games for United that season. So it wasn't, you know, he'd been going to France to get treatment on an injury in preparation for the World Cup. And I think it was just like the build-up of all those years of the FAI not being professional, the FAI not giving the team the best chance with the facilities and the equipment, and even the manager. I mean, there's no doubt that Keane didn't believe McCarthy was the best manager to bring Ireland forward. He was just a guy he was saddled with.
One of the other things, just to finish, Dave, which is really interesting throughout the book, is you chart his relationship with the media. And now he is part of the media. He's not a journalist. He's an analyst. He's a pundit. Although, you know, and he's also got the podcast going, which is sort of the new format of ex-pros sitting around together and chatting about things. But he has always been, hasn't he, been particularly media savvy. He has always known how to play the game.
Yes, he has. And it's a real, you know, I mean, poacher turned gamekeeper thing here, because he was a victim of the tabloidization of Ireland. Like, Ireland became a more tabloid country in the 1990s. And he suffered, I think, at that in a way that he didn't
want. Wasn't he lucky there wasn't social media during the 1990s?
Absolutely. I think we're all happy about that, Matt. all members of the older generation are very happy about that. But just to go back to the point is, you know, you're right. He at a certain point, Keane realized the power that he held. You know, when he gave an interview, it reverberated for days in the media. And I'm sure he realized, I actually am very, very significant. And I you know, when I speak, they listen, and it shakes things up. And, you know, he has monetized that now to tremendous effect and become this kind of, you know, gray-bearded influencer at this point of his career, you know, content machine, whatever you want to call it. But yeah, that power, he realized, I think in the early 2000s, maybe in and around Saipan, he realized how box office he was in terms of media. And now, you know, it's funny that he would probably be making more from the media than just about anybody in the English game, I would say.
And I also think we should acknowledge he's an incredibly generous individual with his time, with people, and also financially. I know various charities, which he does it in a very low-key way, but he does things for people, and he is very generous like that. We need to talk about Roy, The Keenification of Modern Ireland. It's a cracking read. It's not a long read. You get through it very, very quickly, but it brings you through Ireland in the last 40 years in a really, really fascinating way. And there's some great stories I'd forgotten about, such as the time Marty Morrissey went chasing Paul McGrath around Cork Airport and various other stories like that. Dave Hannigan, congratulations on the book. Thank you for joining us.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.